Sparkling Cyanide by Agatha Christie. Read by Hugh Fraser. Book 1. Rosemary. What can I do to drive away remembrances from mine eyes? 6 people were thinking of Rosemary Barton, who had died nearly a year ago. Chapter 1. Iris Marl. Iris Marl was thinking about her sister, Rosemary. For nearly a year, she had deliberately tried to put the thought of Rosemary away from her. She hadn't wanted to remember. It was too painful, too horrible. The blue, cyanosed face, the convulsed, clutching fingers, the contrast between that and the gay, lovely Rosemary of the day before. Well, perhaps not exactly gay. She had had flu. She had been depressed, run down. All that had been brought out at the inquest. Iris herself had laid stress on it. It accounted, didn't it, for Rosemary's suicide? Once the inquest was over, Iris had deliberately tried to put the whole thing out of her mind. Of what good was remembrance? Forget it all. Forget the whole horrible business. But now she realized she had got to remember. She had got to think back into the past, to remember carefully every slight, unimportant-seeming incident. That extraordinary interview with George last night necessitated remembrance. It had been so unexpected, so frightening. Wait. Had it been so unexpected? Hadn't there been indications beforehand? George's growing absorption, his absent-mindedness, his unaccountable actions, his, well, queerness was the only word for it. All leading up to that moment last night when he had called her into the study and taken the letters from the drawer of the desk. So now there was no help for it. She had got to think about Rosemary. To remember. Rosemary. Her sister. With a shock, Iris realized suddenly that it was the first time in her life she had ever thought about Rosemary. Thought about her, that is, objectively, as a person. She had always accepted Rosemary without thinking about her. You didn't think about your mother, or your father, or your sister, or your aunt. They just existed, unquestioned, in those relationships. You didn't think about them as people. You didn't ask yourself even what they were like. What had Rosemary been like? That might be very important now. A lot might depend upon it. Iris cast her mind back into the past. Herself and Rosemary as children. Rosemary had been her elder by 6 years. Glimpses of the past came back, brief flashes, short scenes. Herself as a small child eating bread and milk, and Rosemary, important in pigtails, doing lessons at a table. The seaside one summer, Iris envying Rosemary, who was a big girl and could swim. Rosemary going to boarding school, coming home for the holidays. Then she herself at school, and Rosemary being finished in Paris. Schoolgirl Rosemary, clumsy, all arms and legs. Finished, Rosemary coming back from Paris with a strange, new, frightening elegance. Soft-voiced, graceful, with a swaying, undulating figure, with red-gold chestnut hair and big, black-fringed, dark-blue eyes. A disturbing, beautiful creature, grown up, in a different world. From then on, they had seen very little of each other. The 6-year gap had been at its widest. Iris had still been at school, Rosemary in the full swing of a season. Even when Iris came home, the gap remained. Rosemary's life was one of late mornings in bed, fork luncheons with other debutantes, dances most evenings of the week. Iris had been in the schoolroom with Mademoiselle, had gone for walks in the park, had had supper at 9 o'clock and gone to bed at 10. The intercourse between the sisters had been limited to such brief interchanges as, "Hello, Iris. Telephone for a taxi for me, there's a lamb. I'm going to be devastatingly late." Or, "I don't like that new frock, Rosemary. It doesn't suit you. It's all bunch and fuss." Then had come Rosemary's engagement to George Barton. Excitement, shopping, streams of parcels, bridesmaids' dresses. The wedding. Walking up the aisle behind Rosemary, hearing whispers, "What a beautiful bride she makes." Why had Rosemary married George? Even at the time, Iris had been vaguely surprised. There had been so many exciting young men ringing Rosemary up, taking her out. Why choose George Barton, 15 years older than herself? Kindly, pleasant, but definitely dull. George was well off, but it wasn't money. Rosemary had her own money, a great deal of it. Uncle Paul's money. Iris searched her mind carefully, seeking to differentiate between what she knew now and what she had known then. Uncle Paul, for instance. He wasn't really an uncle. She had always known that. Without ever having been definitely told them, she knew certain facts. Paul Bennett had been in love with their mother. She had preferred another, and a poorer man. Paul Bennett had taken his defeat in a romantic spirit. He had remained the family friend, adopted an attitude of romantic, platonic devotion. He had become Uncle Paul, had stood godfather to the firstborn child, Rosemary. When he died, it was found that he had left his entire fortune to his little goddaughter, then a child of 13. Rosemary, besides her beauty, had been an heiress, and she had married nice, dull George Barton. Why? Iris had wondered then. She wondered now. Iris didn't believe that Rosemary had ever been in love with him. But she had seemed very happy with him, and she had been fond of him. Yes, definitely fond of him. Iris had good opportunities for knowing, for a year after the marriage their mother, lovely, delicate Viola Marl, had died, and Iris, a girl of 17, had gone to live with Rosemary Barton and her husband. A girl of 17. Iris pondered over the picture of herself. What had she been like? What had she felt, thought, seen? She came to the conclusion that that young Iris Marl had been slow of development, unthinking, acquiescing in things as they were. Had she resented, for instance, her mother's earlier absorption in Rosemary? On the whole, she thought not. She had accepted, unhesitatingly, the fact that Rosemary was the important one. Rosemary was out. Naturally, her mother was occupied, as far as her health permitted, with her elder daughter. That had been natural enough. Her own turn would come some day. Viola Marl had always been a somewhat remote mother, preoccupied mainly with her own health, relegating her children to nurses, governesses, schools, but invariably charming to them in those brief moments when she came across them. Hector Marl had died when Iris was 5 years old. The knowledge that he drank more than was good for him had permeated so subtly that she had not the least idea how it had actually come to her. 17-year-old Iris Marl had accepted life as it came, had duly mourned for her mother, had worn black clothes, had gone to live with her sister and her sister's husband at their house in Elveston Square. Sometimes it had been rather dull in that house. Iris wasn't to come out officially until the following year. In the meantime, she took French and German lessons 3 times a week and also attended domestic science classes. There were times when she had nothing much to do and nobody to talk to. George was kind, invariably affectionate and brotherly. His attitude had never varied. He was the same now. And Rosemary? Iris had seen very little of Rosemary. Rosemary had been out a good deal, dressmakers, cocktail parties, bridge. What did she really know about Rosemary, when she came to think of it? Of her tastes, of her hopes, of her fears. Frightening, really, how little you might know of a person after living in the same house with them. There had been little or no intimacy between the sisters. But she'd got to think now. She'd got to remember. It might be important. Certainly, Rosemary had seemed happy enough. Until that day. A week before it happened. She, Iris, would never forget that day. It stood out crystal clear, each detail, each word. The shining mahogany table, the pushed-back chair, the hurried, characteristic writing. Iris closed her eyes and let the scene come back. Her own entry into Rosemary's sitting room, her sudden stop. It had startled her so, what she saw. Rosemary. Sitting at the writing table, her head laid down on her outstretched arms. Rosemary weeping with a deep, abandoned sobbing. She'd never seen Rosemary cry before, and this bitter, violent weeping frightened her. True, Rosemary had had a bad go of flu. She'd only been up a day or two, and everyone knew that flu did leave you depressed. Still, Iris had cried out, her voice childish, startled.
Oh, Rosemary, what is it?
Rosemary sat up, swept her hair back from her disfigured face. She struggled to regain command of herself. She said quickly,
It's nothing, nothing. Don't stare at me like that.
She got up, and passing her sister, she ran out of the room. Puzzled, upset, Iris went farther into the room. Her eyes, drawn wonderingly to the writing table, caught sight of her own name in her sister's handwriting. Had Rosemary been writing to her then? She drew nearer, looked down on the sheet of blue notepaper with the big, characteristic, sprawling writing, even more sprawling than usual, owing to the haste and agitation behind the hand that held the pen. Darling Iris, there isn't any point in my making a will, because my money goes to you anyway. But I'd like certain of my things to be given to certain people. To George, the jewelry he's given me, and the little enamel casket we bought together when we were engaged. To Gloria King, my platinum cigarette case. To Maisie, my Chinese pottery horse that she's always admired. It stopped there, with a frantic scrawl of the pen as Rosemary had dashed it down and given way to uncontrollable weeping. Iris stood as though turned to stone. What did it mean? Rosemary wasn't going to die, was she? She'd been very ill with influenza, but she was all right now. And anyway, people didn't die of flu. At least, sometimes they did, but Rosemary hadn't. She was quite well now, only weak and run down. Iris's eyes went over the words again, and this time a phrase stood out with startling effect. My money goes to you anyway. It was the first intimation she had had of the terms of Paul Bennett's will. She had known since she was a child that Rosemary had inherited Uncle Paul's money, that Rosemary was rich whilst she herself was comparatively poor. But until this moment, she had never questioned what would happen to that money on Rosemary's death. If she had been asked, she would have replied that she supposed it would go to George, as Rosemary's husband, but would have added that it seemed absurd to think of Rosemary dying before George. But here it was, set down in black and white, in Rosemary's own hand. At Rosemary's death, the money came to her, Iris. But surely that wasn't legal. A husband or wife got any money, and not a sister. Unless, of course, Paul Bennett had left it that way in his will. Yes, that must be it. Uncle Paul had said the money was to go to her if Rosemary died. That did make it rather less unfair. Unfair? She was startled as the word leapt to her thoughts. Had she been thinking that it was unfair for Rosemary to get all Uncle Paul's money? She supposed that deep down she must have been feeling just that. It was unfair. They were sisters, she and Rosemary. They were both her mother's children. Why should Uncle Paul give it all to Rosemary? Rosemary always had everything. Parties and frocks and young men in love with her and an adoring husband. The only unpleasant thing that ever happened to Rosemary was having an attack of flu, and even that hadn't lasted longer than a week. Iris hesitated, standing by the desk. That sheet of paper. Would Rosemary want it left about for the servants to see? After a minute's hesitation, she picked it up, folded it in two, and slipped it into one of the drawers of the desk. It was found there after the fatal birthday party, and provided an additional proof, if proof was necessary, that Rosemary had been in a depressed and unhappy state of mind after her illness, and had possibly been thinking of suicide even then. Depression after influenza. That was the motive brought forward at the inquest, the motive that Iris's evidence helped to establish. An inadequate motive, perhaps, but the only one available, and consequently accepted. It had been a bad type of influenza that year. Neither Iris nor George Barton could have suggested any other motive, then. Now, thinking back over the incident in the attic, Iris wondered that she could have been so blind. The whole thing must have been going on under her eyes, and she had seen nothing, noticed nothing. Her mind took a quick leap over the tragedy of the birthday party. No need to think of that. That was over, done with. Put away the horror of that and the inquest and George's twitching face and bloodshot eyes, go straight on to the incident of the trunk in the attic. That had been about 6 months after Rosemary's death. Iris had continued to live at the house in Elveston Square. After the funeral, the Marle family solicitor, a courtly old gentleman with a shining bald head and unexpectedly shrewd eyes, had had an interview with Iris. He had explained with admirable clarity that under the will of Paul Bennett, Rosemary had inherited his estate in trust to pass at her death to any children she might have. If Rosemary died childless, the estate was to go to Iris absolutely. It was, the solicitor explained, a very large fortune, which would belong to her absolutely upon attaining the age of 21, or on her marriage. In the meantime, the first thing to settle was her place of residence. Mr. George Barton had shown himself anxious for her to continue living with him, and had suggested that her father's sister, Mrs. Drake, who was in impoverished circumstances owing to the financial claims of a son, the black sheep of the Marle family, should make her home with them, and chaperone Iris in society. Did Iris approve of this plan? Iris had been quite willing, thankful not to have to make new plans. Aunt Lucilla she remembered as an amiable, friendly sheep, with little will of her own. So the matter had been settled. George Barton had been touchingly pleased to have his wife's sister still with him, and treated her affectionately as a younger sister. Mrs. Drake, if not a stimulating companion, was completely subservient to Iris's wishes. The household settled down amicably. It was nearly 6 months later that Iris made her discovery in the attic. The attics of the Elveston Square house were used as storage rooms for odds and ends of furniture, and a number of trunks and suitcases. Iris had gone up there one day after an unsuccessful hunt for an old red pullover, for which she had an affection. George had begged her not to wear mourning for Rosemary. Rosemary had always been opposed to the idea, he said. This Iris knew was true, so she acquiesced and continued to wear ordinary clothes, somewhat to the disapproval of Lucilla Drake, who was old-fashioned and liked what she called the decencies to be observed. Mrs. Drake herself was still inclined to wear crepe, for a husband deceased some 20-odd years ago. Various unwanted clothes, Iris knew, had been packed away in a trunk upstairs. She started hunting through it for her pullover, coming across as she did so various forgotten belongings, a grey coat and skirt, a pile of stockings, her skiing kit, and one or two old bathing dresses. It was then that she came across an old dressing gown that had belonged to Rosemary, and which had somehow or other escaped being given away with the rest of Rosemary's things. It was a mannish affair of spotted silk with big pockets. Iris shook it out, noting that it was in perfectly good condition. Then she folded it carefully and returned it to the trunk. As she did so, her hand felt something crackle in one of the pockets. She thrust in her hand and drew out a crumpled piece of paper. It was in Rosemary's handwriting, and she smoothed it out and read it. "Leopard, darling, you can't mean it. You can't, we love each other. We belong together. You must know that, just as I know it. We can't just say goodbye and go on coolly with our own lives. You know that's impossible, darling, quite impossible. You and I belong together, forever and ever. I'm not a conventional woman. I don't mind about what people say. Love matters more to me than anything else. We'll go away together and be happy. I'll make you happy. You said to me once that life without me was dust and ashes to you. Do you remember, Leopard, darling? And now you write calmly that all this had better end. But it's only fair to me, fair to me. But I can't live without you. I'm sorry about George. He's always been sweet to me, but he'll understand. He'll want to give me my freedom. It isn't right to live together if you don't love each other anymore. God meant us for each other, darling. I know he did. We're going to be wonderfully happy, but we must be brave. I shall tell George myself. I want to be quite straight about the whole thing, but not until after my birthday. I know I'm doing what's right, Leopard, darling, and I can't live without you. Can't, can't. How stupid it is of me to write all this. Two lines would have done, just, I love you. I'm never going to let you go. Oh, darling. The letter broke off. Iris stood motionless, staring down at it. How little one knew of one's own sister. So, Rosemary had had a lover, had written him passionate love letters, had planned to go away with him. What had happened? Rosemary had never sent the letter after all. What letter had she sent? What had been finally decided between Rosemary and this unknown man? Leopard. What extraordinary fancies people had when they were in love. So silly. Leopard, indeed. Who was this man? Did he love Rosemary as much as she loved him? Surely he must have done. Rosemary was so unbelievably lovely. And yet, according to Rosemary's letter, he had suggested ending it all. That suggested what? Caution? He had evidently said that the break was for Rosemary's sake, that it was only fair to her. Yes, but didn't men say that sort of thing to save their faces? Didn't it really mean that the man, whoever he was tired of it all? Perhaps it had been to him a mere passing distraction. Perhaps he had never really cared. Somehow, Iris got the impression that the unknown man had been very determined to break with Rosemary finally. But Rosemary had thought differently. Rosemary wasn't going to count the cost. Rosemary had been determined, too. Iris shivered. And she, Iris, hadn't known a thing about it, hadn't even guessed, had taken it for granted that Rosemary was happy and contented, and that she and George were quite satisfied with one another. Blind. She must have been blind not to know a thing like that about her own sister. But who was the man? She cast her mind back, thinking, remembering. There had been so many men about, admiring Rosemary, taking her out, ringing her up. There had been no one special. But there must have been. The rest of the bunch were mere camouflage for the one, the only one that mattered. Iris frowned perplexedly, sorting her remembrances carefully. Two names stood out. It must, yes, positively it must be one or the other. Stephen Faraday? It must be Stephen Faraday. What could Rosemary have seen in him? A stiff, pompous young man. And not so very young, either. Of course, people did say he was brilliant. A rising politician. An under-secretaryship prophesied in the near future. And all the weight of the influential Kidderminster connection behind him. A possible future Prime Minister. Was that what had given him glamour in Rosemary's eyes? Surely she couldn't care so desperately for the man himself, such a cold, self-contained creature. But they said that his own wife was passionately in love with him, that she had gone against all the wishes of her powerful family in marrying him, a mere nobody with political ambitions. If one woman felt like that about him, another woman might also. Yes, it must be Stephen Faraday. Because if it wasn't Stephen Faraday, it must be Anthony Brown. And Iris didn't want it to be Anthony Brown. True, he'd been very much Rosemary's slave, constantly at her beck and call, his dark, good-looking face expressing a kind of humorous desperation. But surely that devotion had been too open, too freely declared to go really deep. Odd the way he had disappeared after Rosemary's death. They had none of them seen him since. Still, not so odd, really. He was a man who travelled a lot. He had talked about the Argentine, and Canada, and Uganda, and the USA. She had an idea that he was actually an American, or a Canadian, though he had hardly any accent. No, it wasn't really strange that they shouldn't have seen anything of him since. It was Rosemary who'd been his friend. There was no reason why he should go on coming to see the rest of them. He had been Rosemary's friend, but not Rosemary's lover. She didn't want him to have been Rosemary's lover. That would hurt. That would hurt terribly. She looked down at the letter in her hand. She crumpled it up. She'd throw it away, burn it. It was sheer instinct that stopped her. Someday it might be important to produce that letter. She smoothed it out, took it down with her, and locked it away in her jewel case. It might be important someday to show why Rosemary took her own life. And the next thing, please. The ridiculous phrase came unbidden into Iris's mind and twisted her lips into a wry smile. The glib shopkeeper's question seemed to represent so exactly her own carefully directed mental processes. Was not that exactly what she was trying to do in her survey of the past? She had dealt with the surprising discovery in the attic. And now, on to the next thing, please. What was the next thing? Surely the increasingly odd behavior of George. That dated back for a long time. Little things that had puzzled her became clear now in the light of the surprising interview last night. Disconnected remarks and actions took their proper place in the course of events. And there was the reappearance of Anthony Brown. Yes, perhaps that ought to come next in sequence, since it had followed the finding of the letter by just 1 week. Iris couldn't recall her sensations exactly. Rosemary had died in November. In the following May, Iris, under the wing of Lucilla Drake, had started her social young girl's life. She had gone to luncheons and teas and dances without, however, enjoying them very much. She had felt listless and unsatisfied. It was at a somewhat dull dance towards the end of June that she heard a voice say behind her, "It is Iris Marl, isn't it?" She had turned, flushing, to look into Tony's dark, quizzical face. He said, "I don't expect you to remember me, but..." She interrupted,
"Oh, but I do remember you. Of course I do."
"Splendid. I was afraid you'd have forgotten me. It's such a long time since I saw you."
"I know. Not since Rosemary's birthday pa—"
She stopped. The words had come gaily, unthinkingly to her lips. Now the color rushed away from her cheeks, leaving them white and drained of blood. Her lips quivered. Her eyes were suddenly wide and dismayed. Anthony Brown said quickly, "I'm terribly sorry. I'm a brute to have reminded you." Iris swallowed. She said,
"It's all right."
She hadn't seen him since the night of Rosemary's birthday party. Not since the night of Rosemary's suicide. She wouldn't think of it. She would not think of it. Anthony Brown said again, "I'm terribly sorry. Please forgive me. Shall we dance?" She nodded. Although already engaged for the dance that was just beginning, she had floated onto the floor in his arms. She saw her partner, a blushing, immature young man whose collar seemed too big for him, peering about for her. The sort of partner, she thought scornfully, that Debs have to put up with. Not like this man. Rosemary's friend. A sharp pang went through her. Rosemary's friend. That letter. Had it been written to this man she was dancing with now? Something in the easy, feline grace with which he danced lent substance to the nickname Leopard. Had he and Rosemary? She said sharply,
"Where have you been all this time?"
He held her a little away from him, looking down into her face. He was unsmiling now. His voice held coldness. "I've been traveling. On business."
"I see,"
she went on uncontrollably.
"Why have you come back?"
He smiled then. He said lightly, "Perhaps to see you, Iris Marl." And suddenly, gathering her up a little closer, he executed a long, daring glide through the dancers, a miracle of timing and steering. Iris wondered why, with a sensation that was almost wholly pleasure, she should feel afraid. Since then, Anthony had definitely become part of her life. She saw him at least once a week. She met him in the park, at various dances, found him put next to her at dinner. The only place he never came to was the house in Elveston Square. It was some time before she noticed this, so adroitly did he manage to evade or refuse invitations there. When she did realize it, she began to wonder why. Was it because he and Rosemary... Then, to her astonishment, George, easygoing, non-interfering George, spoke to her about him.
Who's this fellow Anthony Brown you're going about with? What do you know about him?
She stared at him.
Know about him? Why, he was a friend of Rosemary's.
George's face twitched. He blinked. He said in a dull, heavy voice.
Yes, of course. So he was.
Iris cried remorsefully.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't have reminded you.
George Barton shook his head. He said gently,
No, I don't want her forgotten. Never that. After all,
he spoke awkwardly, his eyes averted,
that's what her name means. Rosemary. Remembrance.
He looked full at her.
I don't want you to forget your sister, Iris.
She caught her breath.
I never shall.
George went on. But about this young fellow, Anthony Brown. Rosemary may have liked him, but I don't believe she knew much about him. You know, you've got to be careful, Iris. You're a very rich young woman.
A kind of burning anger swept over her. Tony, Anthony, has plenty of money himself. Why, he stays at Claridge's when he's in London.
George Barton smiled a little. He murmured, Eminently respectable, as well as costly. All the same, my dear, nobody seems to know much about this fellow.
He's an American.
Perhaps. If so, it's odd he isn't sponsored more by his own embassy. He doesn't come much to this house, does he?
No, and I can see why, if you're so horrid about him.
George shook his head. Seemed to have put my foot in it. Oh, well, only wanted to give you a timely warning. I'll have a word with Lucilla.
Lucilla, said Iris scornfully.
George said anxiously, Is everything all right? I mean, does Lucilla see to it that you get the sort of time you ought to have? Parties, all that sort of thing?
Yes, indeed, she works like a beaver.
Because if not, you've only got to say, you know, child. We could get hold of someone else, someone younger and more up to date. I want you to enjoy yourself.
Oh, I do, George. Oh, George, I do.
He said rather heavily. Oh, then, that's all right. I'm not much hand at these shows myself. Never was. But see to it you get everything you want. There's no need to stint on expense.
That was George all over. Kind, awkward, blundering. True to his promise, or threat, he had a word with Mrs. Drake on the subject of Anthony Brown. But as fate would have it, the moment was unpropitious for gaining Lucilla's full attention. She had just had a cable from that ne'er-do-well son, who was the apple of her eye, and who knew only too well how to wring the maternal heartstrings to his own financial advantage. Can you send me £200? Desperate. Life or death. Victor.
Victor is so honourable. He knows how straitened my circumstances are, and he'd never apply to me except in the last resource. He never has. I'm always so afraid he'll shoot himself.
Not he, said George Barton unfeelingly.
Oh, you don't know him. I'm his mother, and naturally I know what my own son is like. I should never forgive myself if I didn't do what he asked. I could manage by selling out those shares.
George sighed. Look here, Lucilla, I'll get full information by cable from one of my correspondents out there. We'll find out just exactly what sort of a jam Victor's in. But my advice to you is to let him stew in his own juice. He'll never make good until you do.
You're so hard, George. The poor boy has always been unlucky.
George repressed his opinions on that point. Never any good arguing with women. He merely said, I'll get Ruth onto it at once. We should hear by tomorrow.
Lucilla was partially appeased. The 200 was eventually cut down to 50, but that amount Lucilla firmly insisted on sending. George, Iris knew, provided the amount himself, though pretending to Lucilla that he was selling her shares. Iris admired George very much for his generosity, and said so. His answer was simple.
Way I look at it, always some black sheep in the family. Always someone who's got to be kept. Someone or other will have to fork out for Victor until he dies.
But it needn't be you. He's not your family.
Rosemary's family's mine.
You're a darling, George. But couldn't I do it? You're always telling me I'm rolling.
He grinned at her. Can't do anything of that kind until you're 21, young woman. And if you're wise, you won't do it then. But I'll give you one tip. When a fellow wires that he'll end everything, unless he gets a couple of £100 by return, you'll usually find that £20 will be ample. I dare say a tenner would do. You can't stop a mother coughing up, but you can reduce the amount. Remember that. Of course, Victor Drake would never do away with himself. Not he. These people who threaten suicide never do it.
Never? Iris thought of Rosemary. Then she pushed the thought away. George wasn't thinking of Rosemary. He was thinking of an unscrupulous, plausible young man in Rio de Janeiro. The net gain, from Iris's point of view, was that Lucilla's maternal preoccupations kept her from paying full attention to Iris's friendship with Anthony Brown. So,
On to the next thing, madam. The change in George. Iris couldn't put it off any longer. When had that begun? What was the cause of it? Even now, thinking back, Iris could not put her finger definitely on the moment when it began. Ever since Rosemary's death, George had been abstracted, had had fits of inattention and brooding. He had seemed older, heavier. That was all natural enough, but when exactly had this abstraction become something more than natural? It was, she thought, after their clash over Anthony Brown, that she had first noticed him staring at her in a bemused, perplexed manner. Then he formed a new habit of coming home early from business and shutting himself up in his study. He didn't seem to be doing anything there. She had gone in once and found him sitting at his desk, staring straight ahead of him. He looked at her when she came in with dull, lackluster eyes. He behaved like a man who has had a shock, but to her question as to what was the matter, he replied briefly, "Nothing." As the days went on, he went about with the careworn look of a man who has some definite worry upon his mind. Nobody had paid very much attention. Iris certainly hadn't. Worries were always conveniently business. Then, at odd intervals and with no seeming reason, he began to ask questions. It was then that she began to put his manner down as definitely queer.
"Look here, Iris, did Rosemary ever talk too much?"
Iris stared at him. "Why, of course, George. At least, well, about what?"
"Oh, herself, her friends. How things were going with her, whether she was happy or unhappy, that sort of thing."
She thought she saw what was on his mind. He must have got wind of Rosemary's unhappy love affair. She said slowly, "She never said much. I mean, she was always busy, doing things."
"And you were only a kid, of course. Yes, I know. All the same, I thought she might have said something."
He looked at her inquiringly, rather like a hopeful dog. She didn't want George to be hurt, and anyway, Rosemary never had said anything. She shook her head. George sighed. He said heavily,
"Oh, well, it doesn't matter."
Another day, he asked her suddenly who Rosemary's best women friends had been. Iris reflected. "Gloria King? Mrs. Atwell, Maisie Atwell. Jean Raymond?"
"How intimate was she with them?"
"Well, I don't know exactly."
"I mean, do you think she might have confided in any of them?"
"I don't really know. I don't think it's awfully likely." "What sort of confidence do you mean?" Immediately, she wished she hadn't asked that last question, but George's response to it surprised her.
"Did Rosemary ever say she was afraid of anybody?"
"Afraid?" Iris stared.
"What I'm trying to get at is this. Did Rosemary have any enemies?"
"Amongst other women?"
No, not that kind of thing. Real enemies. There wasn't anyone that you knew of who might have had it in for her."
Iris's frank stare seemed to upset him. He reddened, muttered,
"Sounds silly, I know, melodramatic, but I just wondered."
It was a day or two after that he had started asking about the Faradays. How much had Rosemary seen of the Faradays? Iris was doubtful. "I really don't know, George."
"Did she ever talk about them?"
"No, I don't think so."
"Were they intimate at all?"
"Rosemary was very interested in politics."
"Yes. After she met the Faradays in Switzerland. Never cared a button about politics before that."
"No, I think Stephen Faraday interested her in them. He used to lend her pamphlets and things." George said,
"What did Sandra Faraday think about it?"
"About what?"
"Well, about her husband lending Rosemary pamphlets."
Iris said uncomfortably, "I don't know." George said,
"She's a very reserved woman. Looks cold as ice. But they say she's crazy about Faraday. Sort of woman who might resent his having a friendship with another woman."
"Perhaps."
"How did Rosemary and Faraday's wife get on?"
Iris said slowly, "I don't think they did. Rosemary laughed at Sandra, said she was one of those stuffed political women like a rocking horse. She is rather like a horse, you know. Rosemary used to say that if you pricked her, sawdust would ooze out." George grunted. Then he said,
"Still seeing a good deal of Anthony Brown?"
"A A fair amount. Iris's voice was cold, but George did not repeat his warnings. Instead, he seemed interested.
Knocked about a good deal, hasn't he? Must have had an interesting life. Does he ever talk to you about it?
Not much. He's travelled a lot, of course.
Business, I suppose.
I suppose so.
What is his business?
I don't know.
Something to do with armament firms, isn't it?
He's never said.
Well, I needn't mention I asked. I just wondered. He was about a lot last autumn with Dewsbury, who's chairman of the United Arms Limited. Rosemary saw rather a lot of Anthony Brown, didn't she?
Yes, she did.
But she hadn't known him very long. He was more or less of a casual acquaintance. He used to take her dancing, didn't he?
Yes.
I was rather surprised, you know, that she wanted him at her birthday party. Didn't realize she knew him so well.
Iris said quietly, "He dances very well."
Yes, of course.
Without wishing to, Iris unwillingly let a picture of that evening flit across her mind. The round table at the Luxembourg, the shaded lights, the flowers, the dance band with its insistent rhythm, the seven people round the table, herself, Anthony Brown, Rosemary, Stephen Faraday, Ruth Lessing, George, and on George's right, Stephen Faraday's wife, Lady Alexander Faraday, with her pale, straight hair and those slightly arched nostrils, and her clear, arrogant voice. Such a gay party it had been. Or hadn't it? And in the middle of it, Rosemary. No, better not think about that. Better only to remember herself sitting next to Tony. That was the first time she had really met him. Before that, he had been only a name, a shadow in the hall, a back accompanying Rosemary down the steps in front of the house to a waiting taxi. Tony. She came back with a start. George was repeating a question.
Funny he cleared off so soon after. Where did he go? Do you know?
She said vaguely.
Oh, Ceylon, I think. Or India.
Never mentioned it that night?
Iris said sharply.
Why should he? And have we got to talk about that night?
His face crimsoned over.
No, of course not. Sorry, old thing. By the way, ask Brown to dinner one night. I'd like to meet him again.
Iris was delighted. George was coming round. The invitation was duly given and accepted, but at the last minute, Anthony had to go north on business and couldn't come. One day at the end of July, George startled both Lucilla and Iris by announcing that he had bought a house in the country.
Bought a house?
Iris was incredulous.
But I thought we were going to rent that house at Goring for 2 months.
Well, nicer to have a place of one's own, eh? Can go down for weekends all through the year.
Where is it? On the river?
Not exactly. In fact, not at all. Sussex. Marlingham. Little Priors, it's called. 12 acres. Small Georgian house.
Do you mean you've bought it without us even seeing it?
Rather a chance. Just came into the market. Snapped it up.
Mrs. Drake said,
I suppose it will need a lot of doing up and redecorating.
George said in an offhand way,
Oh, that's all right. Ruth has seen to all that.
They received the mention of Ruth Lessing, George's capable secretary, in respectful silence. Ruth was an institution, practically one of the family. Good-looking, in a severe black-and-white kind of way, she was the essence of efficiency combined with tact. During Rosemary's lifetime, it had been usual for Rosemary to say, Let's get Ruth to see to it. She's marvellous. Oh, leave it to Ruth. Every difficulty could always be smoothed out by Miss Lessing's capable fingers. Smiling, pleasant, aloof, she surmounted all obstacles. She ran George's office, and it was suspected ran George as well. He was devoted to her, and leaned upon her judgment in every way. She seemed to have no needs, no desires of her own. Nevertheless, on this occasion, Lucilla Drake was annoyed.
My dear George, capable as Ruth is, well, I mean, the women of a family do like to arrange the colour scheme of their own drawing room. Iris should have been consulted. I say nothing about myself, I do not count, but it is annoying for Iris.
George looked conscience-stricken.
I wanted it to be a surprise.
Lucilla had to smile.
What a boy you are, George.
Iris said, "Oh, I don't mind about colour schemes. I'm sure Ruth will have made it perfect. She's so clever. What shall we do down there? There's a tennis court, I suppose."
"Yes, and golf links 6 miles away. And it's only about 14 miles to the sea. What's more, we shall have neighbours. Always wise to go to a part of the world where you know somebody, I think."
"What neighbours?" asked Iris sharply. George did not meet her eyes.
"The Faradays," he said. "They live about 1.5 miles away, just across the park."
Iris stared at him. In a minute she leapt to the conviction that the whole of this elaborate business, the purchasing and equipping of a country house, had been undertaken with one object only: to bring George into close relationship with Stephen and Sandra Faraday. Near neighbours in the country with adjoining estates, the two families were bound to be on intimate terms, either that or a deliberate coolness. But why? Why this persistent harping on the Faradays? Why this costly method of achieving an incomprehensible aim? Did George suspect that Rosemary and Stephen Faraday had been something more than friends? Was this a strange manifestation of post-mortem jealousy? Surely, that was a thought too far-fetched for words. But what did George want from the Faradays? What was the point of all the odd questions he was continually shooting at her, Iris? Wasn't there something very queer about George lately? The odd, fuddled look he had in the evenings. Lucilla attributed it to a glass or so too much of port. Lucilla would. No, there was something queer about George lately. He seemed to be labouring under a mixture of excitement, interlarded with great spaces of complete apathy when he sunk in a coma. Most of that August they spent in the country at Little Priors. Horrible house. Iris shivered. She hated it. A gracious, well-built house, harmoniously furnished and decorated. Ruth Lessing was never at fault. And curiously, frighteningly vacant. They didn't live there. They occupied it, as soldiers in a war occupied some lookout post. What made it horrible was the overlay of ordinary, normal summer living. People down for weekends, tennis parties, informal dinners with the Faradays. Sandra Faraday had been charming to them, the perfect manner to neighbours who were already friends. She introduced them to the county, advised George and Iris about horses, was prettily deferential to Lucilla as an older woman. And behind the mask of her pale, smiling face, no one could know what she was thinking, a woman like a sphinx. Of Stephen they had seen less. He was very busy, often absent on political business. To Iris it seemed certain that he deliberately avoided meeting the Little Priors party more than he could help. So August had passed, and September, and it was decided that in October they should go back to the London house. Iris had drawn a deep breath of relief. Perhaps once they were back, George would return to his normal self. And then last night she had been roused by a low tapping on her door. She switched on the light and glanced at the time. Only 1 o'clock. She had gone to bed at 10:30, and it had seemed to her it was much later. She threw on a dressing gown and went to the door. Somehow that seemed more natural than just to shout, "Come in." George was standing outside. He had not been to bed, and was still in his evening clothes. His breath was coming unevenly, and his face was a curious blue colour. He said,
"Come down to the study, Iris. I've got to talk to you. I've got to talk to someone."
Wondering, still dazed with sleep, she obeyed. Inside the study, he shut the door and motioned her to sit opposite him at the desk. He pushed the cigarette box across to her, at the same time taking one and lighting it, after 1 or 2 attempts with a shaking hand. She said, "Is anything the matter, George?" She was really alarmed now. He looked ghastly. George spoke between small gasps, like a man who has been running.
I can't go on by myself. I can't keep it any longer. You've got to tell me what you think, whether it's true, whether it's possible."
"But what is it you're talking about, George?"
"You must have noticed something, seen something. There must have been something she said. There must have been a reason."
She stared at him. He passed his hand over his forehead.
"You don't understand what I'm talking about. I can see that. Look, don't look so scared, little girl. You've got to help me. You've got to remember every damn thing you can. Now, I know I sound a bit incoherent, but you'll understand in a minute when I've shown you the letters."
He unlocked one of the drawers at the side of the desk and took out two single sheets of paper. They were of a pale, innocuous blue, with words printed on them in small, prim letters.
"Read that," said George.
Aris stared down at the paper. What it said was quite clear and devoid of circumlocution. "You think your wife committed suicide? She didn't. She was killed." The second ran, "Your wife, Rosemary, didn't kill herself. She was murdered." As Iris stayed staring at the words, George went on,
"They came about 3 months ago. At first, I thought it was a joke, a cruel, rotten sort of joke. Then I began to think, why should Rosemary have killed herself?"
Iris said in a mechanical voice,
"Depression after influenza."
"Yes, but really, when you come to think of it, that's rather piffle, isn't it? I mean, lots of people have influenza and feel a bit depressed afterwards, what?"
Iris said with an effort,
"She might have been unhappy."
"Yes, I suppose she might."
George considered the point quite calmly.
"But all the same, I don't see Rosemary putting an end to herself because she was unhappy. She might threaten to, but I don't think she would really do it when it came to the point."
"But she must have done, George. What other explanation could there be? Why, they even found the stuff in her handbag."
I know, it all hangs together, but ever since these came," he tapped the anonymous letters with his fingernail, "I've been turning things over in my mind, and the more I've thought about it, the more I feel sure there's something in it. That's why I've asked you all those questions, about Rosemary ever making any enemies, about anything she'd ever said that sounded as though she were afraid of someone. Whoever killed her must have had a reason."
"But, George, you're crazy."
"Sometimes I think I am. Other times I know that I'm on the right track, but I've got to know, I've got to find out. You've got to help me, Iris. You've got to think. You've got to remember. That's it, remember. Go back over that night again and again. Because you do see, don't you, that if she was killed, it must have been someone who was at the table that night. You see that, don't you?"
Yes, she had seen that. There was no pushing aside the remembrance of that scene any longer. She must remember it all. The music, the roll of drums, the lowered lights, the cabaret, and the lights going up again, and Rosemary sprawled forward on the table, her face blue and convulsed. Iris shivered. She was frightened now, horribly frightened. She must think, go back, remember. Rosemary, that's for remembrance. There was to be no oblivion. Chapter 2. Ruth Lessing. Ruth Lessing, during a momentary lull in her busy day, was remembering her employer's wife, Rosemary Barton. She had disliked Rosemary Barton a good deal. She had never known quite how much until that November morning when she had first talked with Victor Drake. That interview with Victor had been the beginning of it all, had set the whole train in motion. Before then, the things she had felt and thought had been so far below the stream of her consciousness that she hadn't really known about them. She was devoted to George Barton. She always had been. When she had first come to him, a cool, competent young woman of 23, she had seen that he needed taking charge of. She had taken charge of him. She had saved him time, money, and worry. She had chosen his friends for him and directed him to suitable hobbies. She had restrained him from ill-advised business ventures and encouraged him to take judicious risks on occasions. Never once in their long association had George suspected her of being anything other than subservient, attentive, and entirely directed by himself. He took a distinct pleasure in her appearance, the neat, shining, dark head, the smart tailor-mades and crisp shirts, the small pearls in her well-shaped ears, the pale, discreetly powdered face, and the faint, restrained rose shade of her lipstick. Ruth, he felt, was absolutely right. He liked her detached, impersonal manner, her complete absence of sentiment or familiarity. In consequence, he talked to her a good deal about his private affairs, and she listened sympathetically and always put in a useful word of advice. She had nothing to do, however, with his marriage. She did not like it. However, she accepted it, and was invaluable in helping with the wedding arrangements, relieving Mrs. Marle of a great deal of work. For a time after the marriage, Ruth was on slightly less confidential terms with her employer. She confined herself strictly to the office affairs. George left a good deal in her hands. Nevertheless, such was her efficiency that Rosemary soon found that George's Miss Lessing was an invaluable aid in all sorts of ways. Miss Lessing was always pleasant, smiling, and polite. George, Rosemary, and Iris all called her Ruth, and she often came to Elverston Square to lunch. She was now 29, and looked exactly the same as she had looked at 23. Without an intimate word ever passing between them, she was always perfectly aware of George's slightest emotional reactions. She knew when the first elation of his married life passed into an ecstatic content, she was aware when that content gave way to something else that was not so easy to define. A certain inattention to detail shown by him at this time was corrected by her own forethought. However distray George might be, Ruth Lessing never seemed to be aware of it. He was grateful to her for that. It was on a November morning that he spoke to her of Victor Drake.
"I want you to do a rather unpleasant job for me, Ruth."
She looked at him inquiringly. No need to say that certainly she would do it. That was understood.
"Every family's got a black sheep," said George.
She nodded comprehendingly.
"This is a cousin of my wife's, a thoroughly bad hat, I'm afraid. He's half ruined his mother, a fatuous, sentimental soul, who has sold out most of what few shares she has on his behalf. He started by forging a cheque at Oxford. They got that hushed up, and since then he's been shipped about the world, never making good anywhere."
Ruth listened without much interest. She was familiar with the type. They grew oranges, started chicken farms, went as jackaroos to Australian stations, got jobs with meat-freezing concerns in New Zealand. They never made good, never stayed anywhere long, and invariably got through any money that had been invested on their behalf. They had never interested her much. She preferred success.
"He's turned up now in London, and I find he's been worrying my wife. She hadn't set eyes on him since she was a schoolgirl, but he's a plausible sort of scoundrel, and he's been writing to her for money, and I'm not going to stand for that. I've made an appointment with him for 12 o'clock this morning at his hotel. I want you to deal with it for me. The fact is, I don't want to get into contact with the fellow. I've never met him, and I never want to, and I don't want Rosemary to meet him. I think the whole thing can be kept absolutely businesslike if it's fixed up through a third party."
"Yes, that is always a good plan. What is the arrangement to be?"
£100 cash and a ticket to Buenos Aires. The money to be given to him actually on board the boat."
Ruth smiled. "Quite so. You want to be sure he actually sails."
"I see you understand."
"It's not an uncommon case," she said indifferently.
"No, plenty of that type about."
He hesitated.
"Are you sure you don't mind doing this?"
"Of course not." She was a little amused. "I can assure you I'm quite capable of dealing with the matter."
"You're capable of anything."
"What about booking his passage? What's his name, by the way?"
"Victor Drake. The ticket's here. I rang up the steamship company yesterday. It's the San Cristobal. Sails from Tilbury tomorrow."
Ruth took the ticket, glanced over it to make sure of its correctness, and put it into her handbag. "That's settled. I'll see to it. 12 o'clock. What address?"
"The Rupert, off Russell Square."
She made a note of it.
"Ruth, my dear, I don't know what I should do without you."
He put a hand on her shoulder affectionately. It was the first time he had ever done such a thing.
"You're my right hand, my other self."
She flushed, pleased.
"I've never been able to say much. I've taken all you do for granted, but it's not really like that. You don't know how much I rely on you for everything."
He repeated,
"Everything. You're the kindest, dearest, most helpful girl in the world."
Ruth said, laughing to hide her pleasure and embarrassment,
"You'll spoil me, saying such nice things."
"Oh, but I mean them. You're part of the firm, Ruth. Life without you would be unthinkable."
She went out, feeling a warm glow at his words. It was still with her when she arrived at the Rupert Hotel on her errand. Ruth felt no embarrassment at what lay before her. She was quite confident of her powers to deal with any situation. Hard luck stories and people never appealed to her. She was prepared to take Victor Drake as all in the day's work. He was very much as she had pictured him, though perhaps definitely more attractive. She made no mistake in her estimate of his character. There was not much good in Victor Drake. As cold-hearted and calculating a personality as could exist, well masked behind an agreeable devilry. What she had not allowed for was his power of reading other people's souls, and the practiced ease with which he could play on the emotions. Perhaps, too, she had underestimated her own resistance to his charm, for he had charm. He greeted her with an air of delighted surprise. George's emissary! But how wonderful! What a surprise! In dry, even tones, she set out George's terms. Victor agreed to them, in the most amiable manner. £100? Not bad at all. Poor old George. I'd have taken 60, but don't tell him so. Conditions. Do not worry, lovely cousin Rosemary. Do not contaminate innocent cousin Iris. Do not embarrass worthy cousin George. All agreed to. Who is coming to see me off on the San Cristobal? Oh, you are, my dear Miss Lessing, delightful. He wrinkled up his nose. His dark eyes twinkled sympathetically. He had a lean, brown face, and there was a suggestion about him of a toreador. Romantic conception. He was attractive to women, and knew it. You've been with Martin some time, haven't you, Miss Lessing?
6 years.
And he wouldn't know what to do without you. Oh, yes, I know all about it. And I know all about you, Miss Lessing.
How do you know?
Asked Ruth sharply. Victor grinned. Rosemary told me.
Rosemary? But
that's all right. I don't propose to worry Rosemary any further. She's already been very nice to me, quite sympathetic. I got 100 out of her, as a matter of fact.
You...
Ruth stopped, and Victor laughed. His laugh was infectious. She found herself laughing, too.
That's too bad of you, Mr. Drake.
I'm a very accomplished sponger. Highly finished technique. The mater, for instance, will always come across if I send a wire hinting at imminent suicide.
You ought to be ashamed of yourself.
I disapprove of myself very deeply. I'm a bad lot, Miss Lessing. I'd like you to know just how bad.
Why?
She was curious.
I don't know. You're different.
I couldn't play up the usual technique to you. Those clear eyes of yours, you wouldn't fall for it. No. More sinned against than sinning, poor fellow, wouldn't cut any ice with you. You've no pity in you. Her face hardened.
I despise pity. In spite of your name?
Ruth is your name, isn't it?
Piquant, that.
Ruth the Ruthless. She said, I've no sympathy with weakness.
Who said I was weak?
No, no, you're wrong there, my dear. Wicked, perhaps. But there's one thing to be said for me. Her lip curled a little. The inevitable excuse.
Yes?
I enjoy myself. Yes, he nodded. I enjoy myself immensely. I've seen a good deal of life, Ruth. I've done almost everything. I've been an actor, and a storekeeper, and a waiter, and an odd job man, and a luggage porter, and a property man in a circus. I've sailed before the mast in a tramp steamer. I've been in the running for president in a South American republic. I've been in prison. There are only two things I've never done. An honest day's work, or paid my own way. He looked at her, laughing. She ought, she felt, to have been revolted. But the strength of Victor Drake was the strength of the devil. He could make evil seem amusing. He was looking at her now with that uncanny penetration.
You needn't look so smug, Ruth. You haven't as many morals as you think you have. Success is your fetish. You're the kind of girl who ends up by marrying the boss.
That's what you ought to have done with George. George oughtn't to have married that little ass Rosemary. He ought to have married you. He'd have done a damn sight better for himself if he had.
I think you're rather insulting.
Rosemary's a damn fool, always has been. Lovely as paradise and dumb as a rabbit. She's the kind men fall for but never stick to. Now you... You're different. My God. If a man fell in love with you, he'd never tire. He had reached the vulnerable spot. She said with sudden, raw sincerity,
If?
But he wouldn't fall in love with me. You mean George didn't? Don't fool yourself, Ruth. If anything happened to Rosemary, George would marry you like a shot. Yes, that was it. That was the beginning of it all. Victor said, watching her, But you know that as well as I do. George's hand on hers, his voice affectionate, warm. Yes, surely it was true. He turned to her, depended on her. Victor said gently, You ought to have more confidence in yourself, my dear girl. You could twist George round your little finger. Rosemary's only a silly little fool. It's true, Ruth thought. If it weren't for Rosemary, I could make George ask me to marry him. I'd be good to him. I'd look after him well. She felt a sudden blind anger, an uprushing of passionate resentment. Victor Drake was watching her with a good deal of amusement. He liked putting ideas into people's heads, or, as in this case, showing them the ideas that were already there. Yes, that was how it started. That chance meeting with the man who was going to the other side of the globe on the following day. End of Disc 1. Disc 2. The Ruth who came back to the office was not quite the same Ruth who had left it, though no one could have noticed anything different in her manner or appearance. Shortly after she had returned to the office, Rosemary Barton rang up on the telephone.
Mr. Barton has just gone out to lunch. Can I do anything? Oh, Ruth, would you? That tiresome Colonel Race has sent a telegram to say he won't be back in time for my party. Ask George who he'd like to ask instead. We really ought to have another man. There are four women. Iris is coming as a treat, and Sandra Faraday, and... Oh, who on earth the other? Oh, I can't remember.
I'm the fourth, I think. You very kindly asked me.
Oh, of course, I'd forgotten all about you.
Rosemary's laugh came light and tinkling. She could not see the sudden flush, the hard line of Ruth Lessing's jaw. Ask to Rosemary's party as a favour, a concession to George.
Oh, yes, we'll have your Ruth Lessing. After all, she'll be pleased to be asked, and she's awfully useful. She looks quite presentable, too.
In that moment, Ruth Lessing knew that she hated Rosemary Barton. Hated her for being rich and beautiful and careless and brainless. No routine hard work in an office for Rosemary. Everything handed to her on a golden platter. Love affairs, a doting husband, no need to work or plan. Hateful, condescending, stuck-up, frivolous beauty. I wish you were dead, said Ruth Lessing, in a low voice to the silent telephone. Her own words startled her. They were so unlike her. She had never been passionate, never vehement, never been anything but cool and controlled and efficient. She said to herself, What's happening to me? She had hated Rosemary Barton that afternoon. She still hated Rosemary Barton on this day a year later. Some day, perhaps, she would be able to forget Rosemary Barton, but not yet. She deliberately sent her mind back to those November days. Sitting, looking at the telephone, feeling hatred surge up in her heart, giving Rosemary's message to George in her pleasant, controlled voice, suggesting that she herself should not come so as to leave the number even. George had quickly overridden that. Coming in to report next morning on the sailing of the San Cristobal. George's relief and gratitude.
So, he sailed on her all right?
Yes. I handed him the money just before the gangway was taken up.
She hesitated and said,
He waved his hand as the boat backed away from the quay and called out, Love and kisses to George, and tell him I'll drink his health tonight.
Impudence, said George.
He asked curiously,
What did you think of him, Ruth?
Her voice was deliberately colourless as she replied,
Oh, much as I expected. A weak type.
And George saw nothing, noticed nothing. She felt like crying out,
Why did you send me to see him? Didn't you know what he might do to me? Don't you realize that I'm a different person since yesterday? Can't you see that I'm dangerous? That there's no knowing what I may do?
Instead, she said in her businesslike voice, About that San Paolo letter. She was the competent, efficient secretary. 5 more days. Rosemary's birthday. A quiet day at the office. A visit to the hairdresser. the putting on of a new black frock, a touch of make-up skillfully applied, a face looking at her in the glass that was not quite her own face, a pale, determined, bitter face. It was true what Victor Drake had said. There was no pity in her. Later, when she was staring across the table at Rosemary Barton's blue, convulsed face, she still felt no pity. Now, 11 months later, thinking of Rosemary Barton, she felt suddenly afraid. Chapter 3. Anthony Brown. Anthony Brown was frowning into the middle distance as he thought about Rosemary Barton. A damn fool he had been ever to get mixed up with her, though a man might be excused for that. Certainly she was easy upon the eyes. That evening at the Dorchester, he'd been able to look at nothing else. As beautiful as a houri, and probably just about as intelligent. Still, he'd fallen for her rather badly. Used up a lot of energy trying to find someone who would introduce him. Quite unforgivable, really, when he ought to have been attending strictly to business. After all, he wasn't idling his days away at Claridge's for pleasure. But Rosemary Barton was lovely enough in all conscience to excuse any momentary lapse from duty. All very well to kick himself now and wonder why he'd been such a fool. Fortunately, there was nothing to regret. Almost as soon as he spoke to her, the charm had faded a little. Things resumed their normal proportions. This wasn't love, nor yet infatuation. A good time was to be had by all, no more, no less. Well, he'd enjoyed it. And Rosemary had enjoyed it, too. She danced like an angel. And wherever he took her, men turned round to stare at her. It gave a fellow a pleasant feeling, so long as you didn't expect her to talk. He thanked his stars he wasn't married to her. Once you got used to all that perfection of face and form, where would you be? She couldn't even listen intelligently. The sort of girl who would expect you to tell her every morning at the breakfast table that you loved her passionately. Oh, all very well to think of those things now. He'd fallen for her all right, hadn't he? Danced attendance on her. Rung her up, taken her out, danced with her, kissed her in the taxi. Been in a fair way to making rather a fool of himself over her. Until that startling, that incredible day. He could remember just how she'd looked. The piece of chestnut hair that had fallen loose over one ear, the lowered lashes and the gleam of her dark blue eyes through them, the pout of the soft red lips.
Anthony Brown, it's a nice name, he said lightly.
Eminently well-established and respectable. There was a chamberlain to Henry VIII called Anthony Brown.
An ancestor, I suppose.
I wouldn't swear to that.
You'd better not.
He raised his eyebrows. I'm the colonial branch.
Not the Italian one?
Oh, he laughed. My olive complexion. I had a Spanish mother.
Oh, that explains it.
Explains what?
A great deal, Mr. Anthony Brown.
You're very fond of my name.
I said so. It's a nice name.
And then quickly, like a bolt from the blue.
Nicer than Tony Morelli.
For a moment, he could hardly believe his ears. It was incredible, impossible. He caught her by the arm. In the harshness of his grip, she winced away.
Oh, you're hurting me.
Where did you get hold of that name? His voice was harsh, menacing. She laughed, delighted with the effect she had produced. The incredible little fool. Who told you?
Someone who recognized you.
Who was it? This is serious, Rosemary. I've got to know. She shot a sideways glance at him.
A disreputable cousin of mine, Victor Drake.
I've never met anyone of that name.
I imagine he wasn't using that name at the time you knew him, saving the family feelings.
Anthony said slowly, I see. It was, in prison?
Yes. I was reading Victor the Riot Act, telling him he was a disgrace to us all. He didn't care, of course. Then he grinned and said, you aren't always so particular yourself, sweetheart. I saw you the other night dancing with an ex-jailbird. One of your best boyfriends, in fact, calls himself Anthony Brown, I hear. But in stir, he was Tony Morelli.
Anthony said in a light voice, I must renew my acquaintance with this friend of my youth. We old prison ties must stick together. Rosemary shook her head.
Too late. He's been shipped off to South America. He sailed yesterday.
I see. Anthony drew a deep breath. So you're the only person who knows my guilty secret. She nodded.
I won't tell on you.
You'd better not. His voice grew stern. Look here, Rosemary, this is dangerous. You don't want your lovely face carved up, do you? There are people who don't stick at a little thing like ruining a girl's beauty. And there's such a thing as being bumped off. It doesn't only happen in books and films, it happens in real life, too.
Are you threatening me, Tony?
Warning you. Would she take the warning? Did she realize that he was in deadly earnest? Silly little fool. No sense in that lovely empty head. You couldn't rely on her to keep her mouth shut. All the same, he'd have to try and ram his meaning home. Forget you've ever heard the name of Tony Morelli, do you understand?
But I don't mind a bit, Tony. I'm quite broad-minded. It's quite a thrill for me to meet a criminal. You needn't feel ashamed of it.
The absurd little idiot. He looked at her coldly. He wondered, in that moment, how he could ever have fancied he cared. He'd never been able to suffer fools gladly, not even fools with pretty faces. Forget about Tony Morelli, he said grimly. I mean it. Never mention that name again. He'd have to get out. That was the only thing to do. There was no relying on this girl's silence. She'd talk whenever she felt inclined. She was smiling at him, an enchanting smile, but it left him unmoved.
Don't be so fierce. Take me to the Jarrow's dance next week.
I shan't be here. I'm going away.
Not before my birthday party. You can't let me down. I'm counting on you. Now, don't say no. I've been miserably ill with that horrid flu, and I'm still feeling terribly weak. I mustn't be crossed. You've got to come.
He might have stood firm. He might have chucked it all. Gone right away. Instead, through an open door, he saw Iris coming down the stairs. Iris, very straight and slim, with her pale face and black hair and grey eyes. Iris, with much less than Rosemary's beauty, and with all the character that Rosemary would never have. In that moment, he hated himself for having fallen a victim, in however small a degree, to Rosemary's facile charm. He felt as Romeo felt, remembering Rosaline when he had first seen Juliet. Anthony Brown changed his mind. In the flash of a second, he committed himself to a totally different course of action. Chapter 4. Stephen Faraday. Stephen Faraday was thinking of Rosemary, thinking of her with that incredulous amazement that her image always aroused in him. Usually, he banished all thoughts of her from his mind as promptly as they arose, but there were times when, persistent in death, as she had been in life, she refused to be thus arbitrarily dismissed. His first reaction was always the same, a quick, irrepressible shudder, as he remembered the scene in the restaurant. At least he need not think again of that. His thoughts turned further back to Rosemary alive, Rosemary smiling, breathing, gazing into his eyes. What a fool, what an incredible fool he had been. And amazement held him, sheer bewildered amazement. How had it all come about? He simply could not understand it. It was as though his life were divided into two parts. One, the larger part, a sane, well-balanced, orderly progression. The other, a brief, uncharacteristic madness. The two parts simply did not fit. For with all his ability and his clever, shrewd intellect, Stephen had not the inner perception to see that actually they fitted only too well. Sometimes he looked back over his life, appraising it coldly and without undue emotion, but with a certain priggish self-congratulation. From a very early age, he had been determined to succeed in life. And in spite of difficulties and certain initial disadvantages, he had succeeded. He had always had a certain simplicity of belief and outlook. He believed in the will. What a man willed, that he could do. Little Stephen Faraday had steadfastly cultivated his will. He could look for little help in life save that which he got by his own efforts. A small, pale boy of 7 with a good forehead and a determined chin, he meant to rise, and rise high. His parents, he already knew, would be of no use to him. His mother had married beneath her station in life and regretted it. His father, a small builder, shrewd, cunning, and cheese-paring, was despised by his wife and also by his son. For his mother, vague, aimless, and given to extraordinary variations of mood, Stephen felt only a puzzled incomprehension until the day he found her slumped down on the corner of a table with an empty eau de cologne bottle fallen from her hand. He had never thought of drink as an explanation of his mother's moods. She never drank spirits or beer, and he had never realized that her passion for eau de cologne had had any other origin than her vague explanation of headaches. He realized in that moment that he had little affection for his parents. He suspected shrewdly that they had not much for him. He was small for his age, quiet, with a tendency to stammer. Namby-pamby, his father called him. A well-behaved child, little trouble in the house, his father would have preferred a more rumbustuous type.
Always getting into mischief, I was, at his age.
Sometimes, looking at Stephen, he felt uneasily his own social inferiority to his wife. Stephen took after her folk. Quietly, with growing determination, Stephen mapped out his own life. He was going to succeed. As a first test of will, he determined to master his stammer. He practiced speaking slowly, with a slight hesitation between every word, and in time, his efforts were crowned with success. He no longer stammered. In school, he applied himself to his lessons. He intended to have education. Education got you somewhere. Soon, his teachers became interested, encouraged him. He won a scholarship. His parents were approached by the educational authorities. The boy had promise. Mr. Faraday, doing well out of a row of jerry-built houses, was persuaded to invest money in his son's education. At 22, Stephen came down from Oxford with a good degree, a reputation as a good and witty speaker, and a knack of writing articles. He had also made some useful friends. Politics were what attracted him. He had learned to overcome his natural shyness and to cultivate an admirable social manner. Modest, friendly, and with that touch of brilliance that led people to say, "That young man will go far." Though by predilection a liberal, Stephen realized that for the moment at least the Liberal Party was dead. He joined the ranks of the Labour Party. His name soon became known as that of a coming young man. But the Labour Party did not satisfy Stephen. He found it less open to new ideas, more hidebound by tradition than its great and powerful rival. The Conservatives, on the other hand, were on the lookout for promising young talent. They approved of Stephen Faraday. He was just the type they wanted. He contested a fairly solid Labour constituency and won it by a very narrow majority. It was with a feeling of triumph that Stephen took his seat in the House of Commons. His career had begun, and this was the right career he had chosen. Into this he could put all his ability, all his ambition. He felt in him the ability to govern, and to govern well. He had a talent for handling people, for knowing when to flatter and when to oppose. One day, he swore it, he would be in the cabinet. Nevertheless, once the excitement of actually being in the House had subsided, he experienced swift disillusionment. The hardly-fought election had put him in the limelight. Now he was down in the rut, a mere insignificant unit of the rank and file, subservient to the party whips and kept in his place. It was not easy here to rise out of obscurity. Youth here was looked upon with suspicion. One needed something above ability. One needed influence. There were certain interests, certain families. You had to be sponsored. He considered marriage. Up to now, he had thought very little about the subject. He had a dim picture in the back of his mind of some handsome creature who would stand hand in hand with him sharing his life and his ambitions, who would give him children, and to whom he could unburden his thoughts and perplexities. Some woman who felt as he did, and who would be eager for his success and proud of him when he achieved it. Then one day, he went to one of the big receptions at Kidderminster House. The Kidderminster connection was the most powerful in England. They were, and always had been, a great political family. Lord Kidderminster, with his little imperial, his tall, distinguished figure, was known by sight everywhere. Lady Kidderminster's large, rocking-horse face was familiar on public platforms and on committees all over England. They had five daughters, three of them beautiful, and one son still at Eton. The Kidderminsters made a point of encouraging likely young members of the party, hence Faraday's invitation. He did not know many people there, and he was standing alone near a window about 20 minutes after his arrival. The crowd by the tea table was thinning out and passing into other rooms, when Stephen noticed a tall girl in black standing alone by the table, looking for a moment slightly at a loss. Stephen Faraday had a very good eye for faces. He had picked up that very morning in the tube a home gossip discarded by a woman traveller, and glanced over it with slight amusement. There had been a rather smudgy reproduction of Lady Alexandra Hale, third daughter of the Earl of Kidderminster, and below a gossipy little extract about her. Always been of a shy and retiring disposition, devoted to animals. Lady Alexandra has taken a course in domestic science, as Lady Kidderminster believes in her daughters being thoroughly grounded in all domestic subjects. That was Lady Alexandra Hale standing there. And with the unerring perception of a shy person, Stephen knew that she, too, was shy. The plainest of the five daughters, Alexandra had always suffered under a sense of inferiority. Given the same education and upbringing as her sisters, she had never quite attained their savoir-faire, which annoyed her mother considerably. Sandra must make an effort. It was absurd to appear so awkward, so gauche. Stephen did not know that, but he knew that the girl was ill at ease and unhappy. And suddenly, a rush of conviction came to him. This was his chance. Take it, you fool. Take it. It's now or never. He crossed the room to the long buffet. Standing beside the girl, he picked up a sandwich. Then, turning and speaking nervously and with an effort, no acting that, he was nervous, he said, I say, do you mind if I speak to you? I don't know many people here, and I can see you don't either. Don't stun me. As a matter of fact, I'm awfully shy. His stammer of years ago came back at a most opportune moment. And I think you're shy too, aren't you? The girl flushed. Her mouth opened. But as he had guessed, she could not say it. Too difficult to find words to say, I'm the daughter of the house. Instead, she admitted quietly, As a matter of fact, I am shy. I always have been. Stephen went on quickly. It's a horrible feeling. I don't know whether one ever gets over it. Sometimes I feel absolutely tongue-tied. So do I. He went on, talking rather quickly, stammering a little. His manner was boyish, appealing. It was a manner that had been natural to him a few years ago, and which now was consciously retained and cultivated. It was young, naive, disarming. He led the conversation soon to the subject of plays, mentioned one that was running which had attracted a good deal of interest. Sandra had seen it. They discussed it. It had dealt with some point of the social services, and they were soon deep in discussion of these measures. Stephen did not overdo things. He saw Lady Kidderminster entering the room, her eyes in search of her daughter. It was no part of his plan to be introduced now. He murmured a goodbye. I have enjoyed talking to you. I was simply hating the whole show till I found you. Thank you. He left Kidderminster House with a feeling of exhilaration. He had taken his chance. Now to consolidate what he had started. For several days after that, he haunted the neighborhood of Kidderminster House. Once, Sandra came out with one of her sisters. Once she left the house alone, but with a hurried step. He shook his head. That would not do. She was obviously en route to some particular appointment. Then, about a week after the party, his patience was rewarded. She came out one morning with a small, black, Scotty dog, and she turned with a leisurely step in the direction of the park. 5 minutes later, a young man, walking rapidly in the opposite direction, pulled up short and stopped in front of Sandra. He exclaimed blithely, I say, what luck! I wondered if I'd ever see you again. His tone was so delighted that she blushed just a little. He stooped to the dog. What a jolly little fellow! What's his name? A McTavish. Oh, very Scotch. They talked dog for some moments. Then Stephen said, with a trace of embarrassment, I never told you my name the other day. It's Faraday. Stephen Faraday. I'm an obscure MP. He looked inquiringly. and saw the colour come up in her cheeks again as she said, "I'm Alexandra Hale." He responded to that very well. He might have been back in the Ouds. Surprise, recognition, dismay, embarrassment. "Oh, you're Lady Alexandra Hale. You, my goodness, what a stupid fool you must have thought me the other day." Her answering move was inevitable. She was bound both by her breeding and her natural kindliness to do all she could to put him at his ease, to reassure him. "I ought to have told you at the time." "I ought to have known. What an oaf you must think me. How should you have known? What does it matter, anyway? Please, Mr. Faraday, don't look so upset. Let's walk to the Serpentine. Look, McTavish is simply pulling." After that, he met her several times in the park. He told her his ambitions. Together, they discussed political topics. He found her intelligent, well-informed, and sympathetic. She had good brains and a singularly unbiased mind. They were friends now. The next advance came when he was asked to dinner at Kidderminster House and to go on to a dance. A man had fallen through at the last minute. When Lady Kidderminster was racking her brains, Sandra said quietly, "What about Stephen Faraday?"
"Stephen Faraday?"
"Yes, he was at your party the other day, and I've met him once or twice since." Lord Kidderminster was consulted, and was all in favour of encouraging the young hopefuls of the political world.
"Brilliant young fellow, quite brilliant. Never heard of his people, but he'll make a name for himself one of these days."
Stephen came and acquitted himself well.
"A useful young man to know,"
said Lady Kidderminster, with unconscious arrogance. 2 months later, Stephen put his fortunes to the test. They were by the Serpentine, and McTavish sat with his head on Sandra's foot. "Sandra, you know, you must know that I love you. I want you to marry me. I wouldn't ask you if I didn't believe that I shall make a name for myself one day. I do believe it. You shan't be ashamed of your choice, I swear it." She said,
"I'm not ashamed."
"Then you do care?"
"Didn't you know?"
"I hoped, but I couldn't be sure. Do you know that I've loved you since that very first moment when I saw you across the room, and took my courage in both hands and came to speak to you? I was never more terrified in my life." She said,
"I think I loved you then, too."
It was not all plain sailing. Sandra's quiet announcement that she was going to marry Stephen Faraday sent her family into immediate protests. Who was he? What did they know about him? To Lord Kidderminster, Stephen was quite frank about his family and origin. He spared a fleeting thought that it was just as well for his prospects that his parents were now both dead. To his wife, Lord Kidderminster said,
It might be worse.
He knew his daughter fairly well, knew that her quiet manner hid inflexible purpose. If she meant to have the fellow, she would have him. She'd never give in.
"Well, the fellow's got a career ahead of him. With a bit of backing, he'll go far. Heaven knows, we could do with some young blood. He seems a decent chap, too."
Lady Kidderminster assented grudgingly. It was not at all her idea of a good match for her daughter. Still, Sandra was certainly the most difficult of the family. Susan had been a beauty, and Esther had brains. Diana, clever child, had married the young Duke of Harwich, the parti of the season. Sandra had certainly less charm. There was her shyness. And if this young man had a future, as everyone seemed to think, she capitulated, murmuring,
"But of course, one will have to use influence."
So Alexandra Catherine Hale took Stephen Leonard Faraday for better and for worse, in white satin and Brussels lace, with 6 bridesmaids and 2 minute pages and all the accessories of a fashionable wedding. They went to Italy for the honeymoon and came back to a small, charming house in Westminster. And a short time afterwards, Sandra's godmother died and left her a very delightful small Queen Anne Manor house in the country. Everything went well for the young married pair. Stephen plunged into parliamentary life with renewed ardour. Sandra aided and abetted him in every way, identifying herself heart and soul with his ambitions. Sometimes Stephen would think with an almost incredulous realization of how fortune had favoured him. His alliance with the powerful Kidderminster faction assured him of a rapid rise in his career. His own ability and brilliance would consolidate the position that opportunity made for him. He believed honestly in his own powers and was prepared to work unsparingly for the good of his country. Often, looking across the table at his wife, he felt gladly what a perfect helpmate she was, just what he had always imagined. He liked the lovely, clean lines of her head and neck, the direct hazel eyes under the level brows, the rather high white forehead, and the faint arrogance of her aquiline nose. She looked, he thought, rather like a racehorse, so well-groomed, so instinct with breeding, so proud. He found her an ideal companion. Their minds raced alike to the same quick conclusions. Yes, he thought, Stephen Faraday, that little disconsolate boy, had done very well for himself. His life was shaping exactly as he had meant it to. He was only a year or two over 30, and already success lay in the hollow of his hand. And in that mood of triumphant satisfaction, he went with his wife for a fortnight to St. Moritz, and looking across the hotel lounge, saw Rosemary Barton. What happened to him at that moment, he never understood. By a kind of poetic revenge, the words he had spoken to another woman came true. Across a room, he fell in love. Deeply, overwhelmingly, crazily in love. It was the kind of desperate, headlong, adolescent calf love that he should have experienced years ago and got over. He had always assumed that he was not a passionate type of man. One or two ephemeral affairs, a mild flirtation, that, so far as he knew, was all that love meant to him. Sensual pleasures simply did not appeal to him. He told himself that he was too fastidious for that sort of thing. If he had been asked if he loved his wife, he would have replied, certainly. Yet he knew well enough that he would not have dreamt of marrying her if she had been, say, the daughter of a penniless country gentleman. He liked her, admired her, and felt a deep affection for her, and also a very real gratitude for what her position had brought him. That he could fall in love with the abandon and misery of a callow boy was a revelation. He could think of nothing but Rosemary. Her lovely, laughing face, the rich chestnut of her hair, her swaying, voluptuous figure. He couldn't eat, he couldn't sleep. They went skiing together. He danced with her, and as he held her to him, he knew that he wanted her more than anything on earth. So this misery, this aching, longing agony, this was love. Even in his preoccupation, he blessed fate for having given him a naturally imperturbable manner. No one must guess, no one must know what he was feeling, except Rosemary herself. The Bartons left a week earlier than the Faradays. Stephen said to Sandra that St. Moritz was not very amusing. Should they cut their time short and go back to London? She agreed very amiably. 2 weeks after their return, he became Rosemary's lover. A strange, ecstatic, hectic period, feverish, unreal. It lasted, how long, 6 months at most? 6 months, during which Stephen went about his work as usual, visited his constituency, asked questions in the House, spoke at various meetings, discussed politics with Sandra, and thought of one thing only, Rosemary. Their secret meetings in the little flat, her beauty, the passionate endearments he showered on her clinging, passionate embraces, a dream, a sensual, infatuated dream. And after the dream, the awakening. It seemed to happen quite suddenly, like coming out of a tunnel into the daylight. One day he was a bemused lover, the next day he was Stephen Faraday again, thinking that perhaps he ought not to see Rosemary quite so often. Dash it all, they had been taking some terrific risks. If Sandra was ever to suspect... He stole a look at her down the breakfast table. Thank goodness she didn't suspect. She hadn't an idea. Yet some of his excuses for absence lately had been pretty thin. Some women would have begun to smell a rat. Thank goodness Sandra wasn't a suspicious woman. He took a deep breath. Really, he and Rosemary had been very reckless. It was a wonder her husband hadn't got wise to things. One of those foolish, unsuspecting chaps, years older than she was. What a lovely creature she was. He thought suddenly of golf links, Fresh air blowing over sand dunes, tramping round with clubs, swinging a driver, a nice clean shot off the tee, a little chip with a mashie. Men in plus four, smoking pipes, and no women allowed on the links. He said suddenly to Sandra, "Couldn't we go down to Fairhaven?" She looked up, surprised.
"Do you want to? Can you get away?"
"Might take the inside of a week. I'd like to get some golf. I feel stale."
"We could go tomorrow, if you like. It'll mean putting off the Astleys, and I must cancel that meeting on Tuesday. But what about the Lovetts?"
"Oh, let's cancel that, too. We can think of some excuse. I want to get away." It had been peaceful at Fairhaven with Sandra and the dogs on the terrace and in the old walled garden, and with golf at Sandley Heath, and pottering down to the farm in the evening with McTavish at his heels. He had felt rather like someone who is recovering from an illness. He had frowned when he saw Rosemary's writing. He told her not to write, it was too dangerous. Not that Sandra ever asked him who his letters were from, but all the same it was unwise. Servants weren't always to be trusted. He ripped open the envelope with some annoyance, having taken the letter into his study. Pages, simply pages. As he read, the old enchantment swept over him again. She adored him. She loved him more than ever. She couldn't endure not seeing him for 5 whole days. Was he feeling the same? Did the leopard miss his Ethiopian? He half smiled, half sighed, that ridiculous joke. Born when he had bought her a man's spotted dressing gown that she had admired, the leopard changing his spots, and he had said, "But you mustn't change your skin, darling." And after that, she had called him leopard, and he had called her his black beauty. Damned silly, really. Yes, damned silly. Rather sweet of her to have written such pages and pages. But still, she shouldn't have done it. Dash it all, they'd got to be careful. Sandra wasn't the sort of woman who would stand for anything of that kind. If she once got an inkling. Writing letters was dangerous. He'd told Rosemary so. Why couldn't she wait until he got back to town? Dash it all, he'd see her in another 2 or 3 days. There was another letter on the breakfast table the following morning. This time Stephen swore inwardly. He thought Sandra's eyes rested on it for a couple of seconds, but she didn't say anything. Thank goodness she wasn't the sort of woman who asked questions about a man's correspondence. After breakfast, he took the car over to the market town 8 miles away. Wouldn't do to put through a call from the village. He got Rosemary on the phone. "Hello? That's you, Rosemary. Don't write any more letters."
"Stephen, darling, how lovely to hear your voice."
"Be careful. Can anyone overhear you?"
"Of course not. Oh, Angel, I've missed you. Have you missed me?"
Yes, of course. But don't write. It's much too risky."
"Did you like my letter? Did it make you feel I was with you, darling? Darling, I want to be with you every minute. Do you feel that too?"
"Yes, but not on the phone, old thing."
"You're so ridiculously cautious. What does it matter?"
"I'm thinking of you too, Rosemary. I couldn't bear any trouble to come to you through me."
"I don't care what happens to me. You know that."
"Well, I care, sweetheart."
"When are you coming back?"
"Tuesday."
"And we'll meet at the flat Wednesday?"
Yes.
"Darling, I can hardly bear to wait. Can't you make some excuse and come up today? Oh, Stephen, you could. Politics or something stupid like that."
"I'm afraid it's out of the question."
"I don't believe you miss me half as much as I miss you."
"Nonsense, of course I do." When he rang off, he felt tired. Why should women insist on being so damned reckless? Rosemary and he must be more careful in future. They'd have to meet less often. Things after that became difficult. He was busy, very busy. It was quite impossible to give as much time to Rosemary. And the trying thing was, she didn't seem able to understand. He explained, but she just wouldn't listen.
"Oh, your stupid old politics, as though they were important."
"But they are." She didn't realize. She didn't care. She took no interest in his work, in his ambitions, in his career. All she wanted was to hear him reiterate again and again that he loved her.
"Just as much as ever. Tell me again that you really love me."
Surely, he thought, she might take that for granted by this time. She was a lovely creature, lovely. But the trouble was that you couldn't talk to her. The trouble was they'd been seeing too much of each other. You couldn't keep up an affair at fever heat. They must meet less often, slacken off a bit. But that made her resentful, very resentful. She was always reproaching him now.
You don't love me as you used to do?
And then he'd have to reassure her, to swear that of course he did, and she would constantly resurrect everything he had ever said to her.
Do you remember when you said it would be lovely if we died together, fell asleep forever in each other's arms? Do you remember when you said we'd take a caravan and go off into the desert, just the stars and the camels, and how we'd forget everything in the world?
What damned silly things one said when one was in love. They hadn't seemed fatuous at the time. But to have them hashed up in cold blood, why couldn't women let things decently alone? A man didn't want to be continually reminded what an ass he'd made of himself. She came out with sudden, unreasonable demands. Couldn't he go abroad to the south of France, and she'd meet him there? Or go to Sicily or Corsica, one of those places where you never saw anyone you knew? Stephen said grimly that there was no such place in the world. At the most unlikely spots, you always met some dear old school friend that you'd never seen for years. And then she said something that frightened him.
Well, but it wouldn't really matter, would it?
He was alert, watchful, suddenly cold within. What do you mean? She was smiling up at him, that same enchanting smile that had once made his heart turn over and his bones ache with longing. Now it made him merely impatient.
Leopard, darling, I've thought sometimes that we're stupid to go on trying to carry on this hole-and-corner business. It's not worthy, somehow. Let's go away together. Let's stop pretending. George will divorce me, and your wife will divorce you, and then we can get married.
Just like that. Disaster. Ruin. And she couldn't see it. I wouldn't let you do such a thing.
But, darling, I don't care. I'm not really very conventional.
But I am. I am, thought Stephen.
I do feel that love is the most important thing in the world. It doesn't matter what people think of us.
It would matter to me, my dear. An open scandal of that kind would be the end of my career.
But would that really matter? There are hundreds of other things that you could do.
Don't be silly.
Why have you got to do anything anyway? I've got lots of money, you know, of my own. I mean, not George's. We could wander about all over the world, going to the most enchanting out-of-the-way places, places perhaps where nobody else has ever been, or to some island in the Pacific. Think of it, the hot sun, and the blue sea, and the coral reefs.
He did think of it. A South Sea island. Of all the idiotic ideas. What sort of man did she think he was? A beachcomber? He looked at her with eyes from which the last traces of scales had fallen. A lovely creature with the brains of a hen. He'd been mad, utterly and completely mad. But he was sane again now. And he'd got to get out of this fix. Unless he was careful, she'd ruin his whole life. He said all the things that hundreds of men had said before him. They must end it all, so he wrote. It was only fair to her. He couldn't risk bringing unhappiness on her. She didn't understand, and so on and so on. It was all over. He must make her understand that. But that was just what she refused to understand. It wasn't to be as easy as that. She adored him. She loved him more than ever. She couldn't live without him. The only honest thing was for her to tell her husband, and for Stephen to tell his wife the truth. He remembered how cold he had felt as he sat holding her letter. The little fool. The silly, clinging fool. She'd go and blab the whole thing to George Barton, and then George would divorce her and cite him as co-respondent. And Sandra would perforce divorce him, too. He hadn't any doubt of that. She had spoken once of a friend, had said with faint surprise, but of course, when she found out he was having an affair with another woman, what else could she do but divorce him? That was what Sandra would feel. She was proud. She would never share a man. And then he would be done, finished. The influential Kidderminster backing would be withdrawn. It would be the kind of scandal that he would not be able to live down, even though public opinion was broader-minded than it used to be. But not in a flagrant case like this. Goodbye to his dreams, his ambitions, everything wrecked, broken, and all because of a crazy infatuation for a silly woman. Calf love. That was all it had been, calf love contracted at the wrong time of life. He'd lose everything he'd staked. Failure, ignominy. He'd lose Sandra. And suddenly, with a shock of surprise, He realized that it was that he would mind most. He'd lose Sandra. Sandra, with her square white forehead and her clear hazel eyes. Sandra, his dear friend and companion, his arrogant, proud, loyal Sandra. No, he couldn't lose Sandra. He couldn't. Anything but that. The perspiration broke out on his forehead. Somehow, he must get out of this mess. Somehow, he must make Rosemary listen to reason. But would she? Rosemary and reason didn't go together. Supposing he were to tell her that, after all, he loved his wife? No. She simply wouldn't believe it. She was such a stupid woman, empty-headed, clinging, possessive, and she loved him still. That was the mischief of it. A kind of blind rage rose up in him. How on earth was he to keep her quiet? To shut her mouth? Nothing short of a dose of poison would do that, he thought bitterly. A wasp was buzzing close at hand. He stared abstractedly. It had got inside a cut-glass jam pot and was trying to get out. Like me, he thought, entrapped by sweetness. And now? He can't get out, poor devil. But he, Stephen Faraday, was going to get out somehow. Time. He must play for time. Rosemary was down with flu at the moment. He'd sent conventional inquiries, a big sheaf of flowers. It gave him a respite. Next week, Sandra and he were dining with the Bartons. A birthday party for Rosemary. Rosemary had said,
I shan't do anything until after my birthday. It would be too cruel to George. He's making such a fuss about it. He's such a dear. After it's all over, we'll come to an understanding.
Supposing he were to tell her brutally that it was all over, that he no longer cared. He shivered. No. He dare not do that. She might go to George in hysterics. She might even come to Sandra. He could hear her tearful, bewildered voice.
He says he doesn't care any more, but I know it's not true. He's trying to be loyal, to play the game with you. But I know you'll agree with me that when people love each other, honesty is the only way. That's why I'm asking you to give him his freedom.
That was just the sort of nauseating stuff she would pour out. And Sandra, her face proud and disdainful, would say, He can have his freedom. She wouldn't believe. How could she believe? If Rosemary were to bring out those letters. The letters he'd been asinine enough to write to her. Heaven knew what he'd said in them. Enough and more than enough to convince Sandra. Letters such as he had never written to her. He must think of something, some way of keeping Rosemary quiet. It's a pity, he thought grimly, that we don't live in the days of the Borgias. A glass of poisoned champagne was about the only thing that would keep Rosemary quiet. Yes, he had actually thought that. Cyanide of potassium in her champagne glass. Cyanide of potassium in her evening bag. Depression after influenza. And across the table, Sandra's eyes meeting his. Nearly a year ago. And he couldn't forget. Chapter 5. Alexandra Faraday. Sandra Faraday had not forgotten Rosemary Barton. She was thinking of her. Thinking of her slumped forward across the table in the restaurant that night. She remembered her own sharp, indrawn breath, and how then, looking up, she had found Stephen watching her. Had he read the truth in her eyes? Had he seen the hate, the mingling of horror and triumph? Nearly a year ago now, and as fresh in her mind as if it had been yesterday. Rosemary, that's for remembrance. How horribly true that was. It was no good a person being dead if they lived on in your mind. That was what Rosemary had done, in Sandra's mind, and in Stephen's too. She didn't know, but she thought it probable. The Luxembourg, that hateful place with its excellent food, its deft, swift service, its luxurious decor and setting. An impossible place to avoid. People were always asking you there. She would have liked to forget, but everything conspired to make her remember. Even Fairhaven was no longer exempt now that George Barton had come to live at Little Priors. It was really rather extraordinary of him. George Barton was altogether an odd man, not at all the kind of neighbour she liked to have. His presence at Little Priors spoiled for her the charm and peace of Fairhaven. Always, up to this summer, it had been a place of healing and rest, a place where she and Stephen had been happy. That is, if they ever had been happy. Her lips pressed thinly together. Yes, 1,000 times yes. They could have been happy, but for Rosemary. It was Rosemary who had shattered the delicate edifice of mutual trust and tenderness that she and Stephen were beginning to build. Something, some instinct, had bade her hide from Stephen her own passion, her single-hearted devotion. She had loved him from the moment he came across the room to her that day at Kidderminster House, pretending to be shy, pretending not to know who she was, for he had known. She could not say when she had first accepted that fact, sometime after their marriage, one day when he was expounding some neat piece of political manipulation necessary to the passing of some bill. The thought had flashed across her mind then, "This reminds me of something." What? Later, she realized that it was, in essence, the same tactics he had used that day at Kidderminster House. She accepted the knowledge without surprise, as though it were something of which she had long been aware, but which had only just risen to the surface of her mind. From the day of their marriage, she had realized that he did not love her in the same way as she loved him. But she thought it possible that he was actually incapable of such a love. That power of loving was her own unhappy heritage, to care with a desperation, an intensity that was, she knew, unusual among women. She would have died for him willingly. She was ready to lie for him, scheme for him, suffer for him. Instead, she accepted with pride and reserve the place he wanted her to fill. He wanted her cooperation, her sympathy, her active and intellectual help. He wanted of her not her heart, but her brains, and those material advantages which birth had given her. One thing she would never do, embarrass him by the expression of a devotion to which he could make no adequate return. And she did believe honestly that he liked her, that he took pleasure in her company. She foresaw a future in which her burden would be immeasurably lightened, a future of tenderness and friendship. In his way, she thought, he loved her. And then Rosemary came. She wondered sometimes, with a wry, painful twist of the lips, how it was that he could imagine that she did not know. She had known, from the first minute, up there at St. Moritz, when she had first seen the way he looked at the woman. She had known the very day the woman became his mistress. She knew the scent the creature used. She could read in Stephen's polite face, with eyes abstracted, just what his memories were, what he was thinking about. That woman. The woman he had just left. It was difficult, she thought dispassionately, to assess the suffering she had been through. Enduring day after day the tortures of the damned, with nothing to carry her through but her belief in courage, her own natural pride. She would not show, she would never show, what she was feeling. She lost weight, grew thinner and paler, the bones of her head and shoulders showing more distinctly, with the flesh stretched tightly over them. She forced herself to eat, but could not force herself to sleep. She lay, long nights with dry eyes, staring into darkness. She despised the taking of drugs as weakness. She would hang on, to show herself hurt, to plead, to protest. All these things were abhorrent to her. She had one crumb of comfort, a meager one. Stephen did not wish to leave her. Granted that that was for the sake of his career, not out of fondness for her, still the fact remained. He did not want to leave her. Some day, perhaps, the infatuation would pass. What could he, after all, see in the girl? She was attractive, beautiful, but so were other women. What did he find in Rosemary Barton that infatuated him? She was brainless, silly, and not, she clung to this point especially, not even particularly amusing. If she had had wit, charm, and provocation of manner, those were the things that held men. Sandra clung to the belief that the thing would end, that Stephen would tire of it. She was convinced that the main interest in his life was his work. He was marked out for great things, and he knew it. He had a fine, statesmanlike brain, and he delighted in using it. It was his appointed task in life. Surely, once the infatuation began to wane, he would realize that fact. Never for 1 minute did Sandra consider leaving him. The idea never even came to her. She was his, body and soul, to take or discard. He was her life, her existence. Love burned in her with a medieval force. There was a moment when she had hope. They went down to Fairhaven. Stephen seemed more his normal self. She felt suddenly a renewal of the old sympathy between them. Hope rose in her heart. He wanted her still. He enjoyed her company. He relied on her judgment. For the moment, he had escaped from the clutches of that woman. He looked happier, more like his own self. Nothing was irretrievably ruined. He was getting over it. If only he could make up his mind to break with her. Then they went back to London, and Stephen relapsed. He looked haggard, worried, ill. He began to be unable to fix his mind on his work. She thought she knew the cause. Rosemary wanted him to go away with her. He was making up his mind to take the step to break with everything he cared about most. Folly, madness. He was the type of man with whom his work would always come first, a very English type. He must know that himself, deep down. Yes, but Rosemary was very lovely, and very stupid. Stephen would not be the first man who had thrown away his career for a woman and been sorry afterwards. Sandra caught a few words, a phrase, one day at a cocktail party.
Telling George. Got to make up our minds.
It was soon after that that Rosemary went down with the flu. A little hope rose in Sandra's heart. Suppose she were to get pneumonia. People did after flu. A young friend of hers had died that way only last winter. If Rosemary were to die... She did not try to repress the thought. She was not horrified at herself. She was medieval enough to hate with a steady and untroubled mind. She hated Rosemary Barton. If thoughts could kill, she would have killed her. But thoughts do not kill. Thoughts are not enough. How beautiful Rosemary had looked that night at the Luxembourg with her pale fox furs slipping off her shoulders in the ladies' cloakroom. Thinner, paler since her illness. An air of delicacy made her beauty more ethereal. She had stood in front of the glass, touching up her face. Sandra, behind her, looked at their joint reflection in the mirror, her own face like something sculptured. Cold, lifeless. No feeling there, you would have said. A cold, hard woman. And then Rosemary said,
"Oh, Sandra, am I taking all the glass? I'm finished now. This horrid flu has pulled me down a lot. I look a sight, and I feel quite weak still and headachy."
Sandra had asked with a quiet, polite concern,
"Have you got a headache tonight?" "Oh, just a bit of one. You haven't got an aspirin, have you?"
"I've got a cachet fèvre."
She had opened her handbag, taken out the cachet. Rosemary had accepted it.
"I'll take it in my bag, in case."
That competent, dark-haired girl, Barton's secretary, had watched the little transaction. She came in turn to the mirror and just put on a slight dusting of powder. A nice-looking girl, almost handsome. Sandra had the impression that she didn't like Rosemary. Then they had gone out of the cloakroom. Sandra first, then Rosemary, then Miss Lessing. Oh, and of course, the girl Iris. Rosemary's sister, she had been there. Very excited, with big grey eyes and a schoolgirlish white dress. They had gone out and joined the men in the hall. And the head waiter had come bustling forward and showed them to their table. They had passed in under the great domed arch. And there had been nothing, absolutely nothing, to warn one of them that she would never come out through that door again, alive. Chapter 6. George Barton. Rosemary. George Barton lowered his glass and stared rather owlishly into the fire. He had drunk just enough to feel maudlin with self-pity. What a lovely girl she had been. He'd always been crazy about her. She knew it. But he'd always supposed she'd only laugh at him. Even when he first asked her to marry him, he hadn't done it with any conviction. Mowed and mumbled, acted like a blithering fool.
You know, old girl, any time, you've only got to say, I know it's no good. You wouldn't look at me. I've always been the most awful fool. Got a bit of a corporation, too. But you do know what I feel, don't you? Eh? I mean, I'm always there. No, I haven't got an earthly chance, but thought I'd just mention it.
And Rosemary had laughed and kissed the top of his head.
Oh, you're sweet, George. And I'll remember the kind offer.
but I'm not marrying anyone just at present. But he had said seriously,
Oh, quite right. Take plenty of time to look around. You can take your pick.
He'd never had any hope, not any real hope. That's why he'd been so incredulous, so dazed, when Rosemary had said she was going to marry him. She wasn't in love with him, of course. He knew that quite well. In fact, she admitted as much.
You do understand, don't you? I want to feel settled down and happy and safe. I shall with you. I'm so sick of being in love. It always goes wrong somehow and ends in a mess. I like you, George. You're nice and funny and sweet, and you think I'm wonderful. That's what I want.
He had answered rather incoherently.
Steady, does it? We'll be happy as kings.
Well, that hadn't been far wrong. They had been happy. He'd always felt humble in his own mind. He'd always told himself that there were bound to be snags. Rosemary wasn't going to be satisfied with a dull kind of chap like himself. There would be incidents. He'd schooled himself to accept incidents. He would hold firm to the belief that they wouldn't be lasting. Rosemary would always come back to him. Once let him accept that view, and all would be well. For she was fond of him. Her affection for him was constant and unvarying. It existed quite apart from her flirtations and her love affairs. He had schooled himself to accept those. He had told himself that they were inevitable, with someone of Rosemary's susceptible temperament and unusual beauty. What he had not bargained for were his own reactions. Flirtations with this young man and that were nothing, but when he first got an inkling of a serious affair, he had known quick enough, sensed the difference in her, the rising excitement, the added beauty, the whole glowing radiance. And then, what his instinct told him was confirmed by ugly, concrete facts. There was that day when he'd come into her sitting room, and she had instinctively covered with her hand the page of the letter she was writing. He'd known then. She was writing to her lover. Presently, when she went out of the room, he went across to the blotter. She had taken the letter with her, but the blotting sheet was nearly fresh. He'd taken it across the room and held it up to the glass, seen the words in Rosemary's dashing script, My own beloved darling. His blood had sung in his ears. He understood in that moment just what Othello had felt. Wise resolutions? Only the natural man counted. He'd like to choke the life out of her. He'd like to murder the fellow in cold blood. Who was it? That fellow Brown, or that stick Stephen Faraday? They'd both of them be making sheep's eyes at her. He caught sight of his face in the glass. His eyes were suffused with blood. He looked as though he were going to have a fit. As he remembered that moment, George Barton let his glass fall from his hand. Once again he felt the choking sensation, the beating blood in his ears. Even now, with an effort, he pushed remembrance away. Mustn't go over that again. It was past, done with. He wouldn't ever suffer like that again. Rosemary was dead, dead and at peace. And he was at peace, too. No more suffering. Funny to think that that was what her death had meant to him. Peace. He'd never told even Ruth that. Good girl, Ruth. A good headpiece on her. Really, he didn't know what he would do without her. The way she helped, the way she sympathized. Never a hint of sex. Not man-mad like Rosemary. Rosemary. Rosemary sitting at the round table in the restaurant, a little thin in the face after the flu. A little pulled down, but lovely, so lovely. And only an hour later, no. He wouldn't think of that, not just now. His plan. He would think of the plan. He'd speak to Race first. He'd show Race the letters. What would Race make of these letters? Iris had been dumbfounded. She evidently hadn't had the slightest idea. Well, he was in charge of the situation now. He'd got it all taped. The plan. All worked out. The date. The place. November the 2nd, All Souls Day. That was a good touch. The Luxembourg, of course. He'd try to get the same table. And the same guests. Anthony Brown, Stephen Faraday, Sandra Faraday, then of course Ruth, and Iris, and himself. And as the odd, the seventh guest, he'd get Race. Race, who was originally to have been at the dinner. And there would be one empty place. It would be splendid, dramatic, a repetition of the crime. Well, Not quite a repetition. His mind went back. Rosemary's birthday. Rosemary, sprawled forward on that table. Dead.
End of disc 2. Disc 3.
Book 2. All Souls' Day. There's Rosemary. That's for remembrance. Chapter 1. Lucilla Drake was twittering. That was the term always used in the family, and it was really a very apt description of the sounds that issued from Lucilla's kindly lips. She was concerned on this particular morning with many things, so many that she found it hard to pin her attention down to one at a time. There was the imminence of the move back to town and the household problems involved in that move. Servants, housekeeping, winter storage, 1,000 minor details, all these contended with a concern over Iris's looks.
Really, dear, I feel quite anxious about you. You look so white and washed out as though you hadn't slept. Did you sleep? If not, there's that nice sleeping preparation of Dr. Wiley's, or was it Dr. Gaskell's? Which reminds me, I shall have to go and speak to the grocer myself. Either the maids have been ordering things in on their own, or else it's deliberate swindling on his part. Packets and packets of soap flakes, and I never allow more than 3 a week, but perhaps a tonic would be better. Eton syrup they used to give when I was a girl, and spinach, of course. I'll tell cook to have spinach for lunch today.
Iris was too languid and too used to Mrs. Drake's discursive style to inquire why the mention of Dr. Gaskell should have reminded her aunt of the local grocer, though had she done so, she would have received the immediate response, "Because the grocer's name is Cranford, my dear." Aunt Lucilla's reasoning was always crystal clear to herself. Iris merely said, with what energy she could command,
"I'm perfectly well, Aunt Lucilla." "Black under the eyes," said Mrs. Drake. "You've been doing too much." "I've done nothing at all, for weeks." "So you think, dear, that too much tennis is overtiring for young girls, and I think the air down here is inclined to be enervating. This place is in a hollow. If George had consulted me instead of that girl..." "Girl? That Miss Lessing he thinks so much of. All very well in the office, I dare say, but a great mistake to take her out of her place. Encourage her to think of herself as one of the family. Not that she needs any encouragement, I should say." "Oh, well, Aunt Lucilla, Ruth is practically one of the family." Mrs. Drake sniffed. "She means to be, that's quite clear. Poor George. Really, an infant in arms where women are concerned. But it won't do, Iris. George must be protected from himself, and if I were you, I should make it very clear that nice as Miss Lessing is, any idea of marriage is out of the question." Iris was startled for a moment out of her apathy. "I never thought of George marrying Ruth. You don't see what goes on under your nose, child. Of course, you haven't had my experience of life." Iris smiled in spite of herself. Aunt Lucilla was really very funny sometimes. "That young woman is out for matrimony." "Would it matter?" asked Iris.
"Matter? Of course it would matter."
"Wouldn't it really be rather nice?"
Her aunt stared at her.
"The nice for George, I mean. I think you're right about her, you know. I think she is fond of him. And she'd be an awfully good wife to him and look after him."
Mrs. Drake snorted, and an almost indignant expression appeared on her rather sheep-like, amiable face.
"George is very well looked after at present. What more can he want, I should like to know? Excellent meals, and his mending seen to. Very pleasant for him to have an attractive young girl like you about the house. And when you marry some day, I should hope I was still capable of seeing to his comfort and looking after his health, just as well or better than a young woman out of an office could do. What does she know about housekeeping? Figures and ledgers and shorthand and typing, what good is that in a man's home?"
Iris smiled and shook her head, but she did not argue the point. She was thinking of the smooth, dark satin of Ruth's head, of the clear complexion and the figure so well set off by the severe tailor-made clothes that Ruth affected. Poor Aunt Lucilla, all her mind on comfort and housekeeping, with romance so very far behind her that she had probably forgotten what it meant. If, indeed, thought Iris, remembering her uncle by marriage, it had ever meant much. Lucilla Drake had been Hector Marr's half-sister, the child of an earlier marriage. She had played the little mother to a very much younger brother when his own mother died. Housekeeping for her father, she had stiffened into a pronounced spinsterhood. She was close on 40 when she met the Reverend Caleb Drake, he himself a man over 50. Her married life had been short, a mere 2 years. Then she had been left a widow with an infant son. Motherhood, coming late and unexpectedly, had been the supreme experience of Lucilla Drake's life. Her son had turned out an anxiety, a source of grief, and a constant financial drain, but never a disappointment. Mrs. Drake refused to recognize anything in her son Victor except an amiable weakness of character. Victor was too trusting, too easily led astray by bad companions because of his own belief in them. Victor was unlucky. Victor was deceived. Victor was swindled. He was the cat's paw of wicked men who exploited his innocence. The pleasant, rather silly sheep's face hardened into obstinacy when criticism of Victor was to the fore. She knew her own son. He was a dear boy, full of high spirits, and his so-called friends took advantage of him. She knew none better how Victor hated having to ask her for money. But when the poor boy was really in such a terrible situation, what else could he do? It wasn't as though he had anyone but her to go to. All the same, as she admitted, George's invitation to come and live in the house and look after Iris had come as a godsend, at a moment when she really had been in desperate straits of genteel poverty. She had been very happy and comfortable this last year, and it was not in human nature to look kindly on the possibility of being superseded by an upstart young woman, all modern efficiency and capability, who in any case, so she persuaded herself, would only be marrying George for his money. Of course, that was what she was after. A good home and a rich, indulgent husband. You couldn't tell Aunt Lucilla at her age that any young woman really liked working for her living. Girls were the same as they had always been. If they could get a man to keep them in comfort, they much preferred it. This Ruth Lessing was clever, worming her way into a position of confidence, advising George about house furnishing, making herself indispensable, but thank goodness there was one person, at least, who saw what she was up to. Lucilla Drake nodded her head several times, causing her soft double chins to quiver, raised her eyebrows with an air of superb human sapience, and abandoned the subject for one equally interesting and possibly even more pressing. "It's the blankets I can't make my mind up about, dear. You see, I can't get it clearly laid down whether we shan't be coming down again until next spring, or whether George means to run down for weekends. He won't say." "I suppose he doesn't really know." Iris tried to give her attention to a point that seemed completely unimportant. "If it was nice weather, it might be fun to come down occasionally, though I don't think I want to particularly. Still, the house would be here if we do want to come." "Yes, dear, but one wants to know, because, you see, if we aren't coming down until next year, then the blankets ought to be put away with mothballs. But if we are coming down, that wouldn't be necessary, because the blankets would be used, and the smell of mothballs is so unpleasant." "Well, don't use them." "Yes, but it's been such a hot summer, there are a lot of moths about. Everyone says it's a bad year for moths, and for wasps, of course. Hawkins told me yesterday he's taken 30 wasps' nests this summer. 30! Just fancy!" Iris thought of Hawkins, stalking out at dusk, cyanide in hand. Cyanide. Rosemary. Why did everything lead back to that? The thin trickle of sound that was Aunt Lucilla's voice was going on. It had reached by now a different point. "And whether one ought to send the silver to the bank or not. Lady Alexandra was saying so many burglaries, though, of course, we do have good shutters. I don't like the way she does her hair myself. It makes her face look so hard. But I should think she was a hard woman, and nervy, too. Everyone is nervy nowadays. When I was a girl, people didn't know what nerves were. Which reminds me that I don't like the look of George lately. I wonder if he could be going to have flu. I wondered, once or twice, whether he was feverish. But perhaps it's some business worry. He looks to me, you know, as though he's got something on his mind." Iris shivered, and Lucilla Drake exclaimed triumphantly, "There! I said you had a chill!" Chapter 2. "How I wish they had never come here!" Sandra Faraday uttered the words with such unusual bitterness that her husband turned to look at her in surprise. It was as though his own thoughts had been put into words, the thoughts that he had been trying so hard to conceal. So, Sandra too felt as he did. She too had felt that Fairhaven was spoiled, its peace impaired by these new neighbours a mile away across the park. He said, voicing his surprise impulsively, "I didn't know you felt like that about them too." Immediately, or so it seemed to him, she withdrew into herself.
Neighbours are so important in the country. One has either to be rude or friendly. One can't, as in London, just keep people as amiable acquaintances.
No, said Stephen, one can't do that.
And now we're committed to this extraordinary party.
They were both silent, running over in their minds the scene at lunch. George Barton had been friendly, even exuberant in manner, with a kind of undercurrent of excitement of which they had both been conscious. George Barton was really very odd these days. Stephen had never noticed him much in the time preceding Rosemary's death. George had just been there in the background, the kindly, dull husband of a young and beautiful wife. Stephen had never even felt a pang of disquiet over the betrayal of George. George had been the kind of husband who was born to be betrayed. So much older, so devoid of the attractions necessary to hold an attractive and capricious woman. Had George himself been deceived? Stephen did not think so. George, he thought, knew Rosemary very well. He loved her, and he was the kind of man who was humble about his own powers of holding a wife's interest. All the same, George must have suffered. Stephen began to wonder just what George had felt when Rosemary died.